Anyone with any comments or questions related to this?
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I was keeping track. The first person to get the injection here in New York was over in Long Island Jewish Hospital. I counted the days, and that would be tomorrow would be, you know, her day would be up. So I guess they're going to start with second injections now.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, that's the plan. The problems, though, have been distribution. I don't know why the problems have been distribution, but whereas I think the companies have manufactured, you know, tens of millions of vials, last time I checked, there were only about 3 million people vaccinated. You could have gone up from that number that I saw a couple of days ago, but we really got to figure out how to streamline the distribution and protect it. Everyone's probably heard the story of the guy in Wisconsin who let 500 vials go bad by not keeping them in the freezer for some strange reason and then giving them to people. So, you know, we got to kind of strain out the lunatics, if that's possible, and streamline the distribution network. But, you know, I think ultimately, you know, as long as we take this seriously, I was very upset to hear that the airline industry is doing very well recently. People are traveling for the holidays. So we're going to get another blast of hospitalizations and deaths in about 3 weeks again, unfortunately. But, I mean, eventually we will get to the other end of the tunnel. Hopefully it won't be the light of another train ready to hit us.
Okay, I agree. And I hope they get their act together. I was thinking bring out the National Guard, I mean, you know, throughout every state. I think they would probably be good at something like that, you know? I think that would be right up their alley. Maybe they'll try that. What do you think, Roy?
I think, unfortunately, the problem is higher up in the command structure. I don't think the problem, at least from what I heard, is not actually people handling the trucks and moving things. It's figuring out where to send them. Early shipments, they sent massive quantities to very small medical facilities that didn't need most of the stuff, so, and they couldn't maintain the temperature, and other places had to wait for it in storage because the people who regulated where it goes were kind of slowed on the uptake. So I think we need either military or some organizational person at the very tippity top who's setting up where this stuff should go in a very quick, timely basis. I think we have enough hands on the ground. I may be wrong, but we need some brains at the top.
Okay. I just saw a piece the other day about smallpox. Some guy came in from Mexico and went up to New York in 1947. And, you know, they realized he had smallpox. And inside, I think they said inside of a month or something like that, they injected him. And that's, you know, decades ago. So they should be doing better, I guess. But what do I know? Back to you, Rick.
Yeah, I saw that story as well. A guy on MSNBC kind of opened his show with that story. There's a couple of little things to keep in mind. Number one, smallpox vaccine was readily available at the time. It's just that there was no particular need to vaccinate people because there were no epidemics going on. So they had supplies. Also, it only affected New York City, so it was very, very small region. But thankfully, it was managed by, I think, a physician who basically turned the whole operation into a well-run system. Every single person, they were injecting pole dancers, they were injecting nuns, they were injecting streetwalkers, they were injecting everyone. The entire city of New York got vaccinated pretty much over that 1 month time. So they did a great job, but the job was a slightly different job than the one that we have now. So gold stars for everyone involved then. I wish they were alive and able to do it for us again. But the situation was a little different.
Okay. It's a question that a doctor might have a good answer for. In the early 60s, I remember getting this sugar cube, this pink sugar cube, you know, for polio as a kid. You know, everybody went down to the cafeteria in the school, and they all lined up and got these things. And, you know, why can't they do that? I mean, you know, what's the problem with, for that matter, any vaccine? What makes one different than the other? Why would that one work and this one not? Or is it because of the new RNA, mRNA system that they're using? That would be good. You know, just shrink it down to a cube, hand it out to everybody, and they're off to the races that way now.
Well, I mean, that sort of touches upon, there was a question at the White House whether or not a flu shot would immunize people for COVID-19. The problem is that polio is a completely different virus. It works differently. It's based on a different set of principles of getting into the system. And so you can't design, unfortunately, it would be great, but you can't really design one vaccine that fits all. The Sabin and Salk vaccine, Salk was the injectable, Sabin was the oral agent. I think they were attenuated polio viral particles. You wouldn't want to do that with attenuated COVID-19 virus particles. And it would take much longer to sort of develop something that would trigger your immune system, but not infect you. And so it's apples and oranges. It would be nice if you could just get something as simple as that, but they decided on the messenger RNA, which has the benefit of a very rapid turnaround. It took, I think, 10, 12 years to get the polio vaccine, but it took about 6-7 months to get these messenger RNAs. The downside is that they both require a booster shot. So in the world of vaccines, it's much better to have a vaccine that's a one-shot deal than a two-shot deal. But, you know, we needed it fast. So eventually, you know, if and when people need to use a vaccine for COVID-19 and they find one that's a single shot, that will probably become the overwhelming favorite. But, you know, you have what you got. Can I say?
Okay, well, thanks for that. I got my fingers crossed. I don't want to, hope they don't do like what they're doing out in Florida. I can't imagine sitting on a 5-hour line in the middle of the winter up north. At least they got a shot down in Florida, but not up here. Wait. Hope they get their act together. Got my fingers crossed. Back to you, Roy. Thanks. WS2N.
N2RQ.
Yes, N2RQ.
Hey, good evening, Roy. Thanks for the email before. I really have a question on this and an anecdote to convey. I spoke to a friend in Florida a while ago, and he was able to log in on a website in a county that's not where he lives and get an appointment for the vaccine. Don't know which vaccine, but an appointment for this week. And he said the window that they give you is a one-minute window. I don't know the details yet. I'll find out after his appointment. The other thing that I had a question on was, do we know in the development of these vaccines if the protocol of CRISPR was involved?
okay, the first point is the problem is that none of this is a universal. Everyone and their brother with a supply is using a different means or method to dispense it. So if you can find a medical facility that's taking appointments to get the shots, then, you know, jump on top of it. But it's very spotty, and, you know, again, unfortunately, there's no master control running any of this. It's a whole bunch of people running around in the dark, so that's that aspect. I am not aware of CRISPR being involved in this particular set of vaccines, in that these vaccines do not attach changes to something like an adenovirus, which the United Kingdom is working on. I think it's Oxford. So I could see them using CRISPR to implant the important gene sequences. But messenger RNA is basically doesn't, I think, require that. So I might be wrong, but I do not believe CRISPR was involved in the messenger RNA technology.
Okay, thank you. I just thought that other story with friends was interesting. If I get a response from him, we'll find out. But it really is a response to what Paul was saying. It's a crazy scramble down there. Who knows where it's going to go. Anyway, thank you. And to our team.
And I have a short question from that what you said before.
Yeah, sure, Wes.
You mentioned gravitational lensing. Gravitational lensing occurs to the wavelength of light from radio and infrared to visible and ultraviolet, which makes sense since they are all part of the spectrum of electromagnetic radiation in the universe. The first gravitational lenses, the pair of bright objects in the center of the image, were once thought to be twin quasars. And sources of gravitational waves can undergo microlensing due to lenses in the disk hollow of the galaxy. Let me up. Or due to the lenses in an interfering galaxy, even in the absence of strong lensing. In general, probability for this is small, with one exception. Extragalactic sources of gravitational waves that lie in the galactic plane and highly likely to be microlensed. How that applies to any frequency of radio waves in the Earth?
I don't think that I was alluding to the fact that there's gravitational, well, this to a degree there's gravitational lensing, because the Earth does warp space-time, but it's inconsequential. I was just making the point that gravitational lensing does shift the path of anything traveling at a straight line. It's not inherent to a certain range of frequencies of electromagnetic waves. It's all electromagnetic waves. It's all particles that are going at a given set velocity, and their inertia is conserved. Since gravitational warps, gravitational lensing is just another way of saying that gravitational fields are being warped, and objects that are supposed to be traveling in a straight line because that's what they're designed to inertially do, will be seen to go off that straight line simply because space-time itself is curved and it's following that curve. That's all I said.
Yeah, I was thinking about what you said, and I was trying to see if there is any impact on that, what you're talking about. We're talking about ham radio communication, all the waves, or the waves. And at first I said, well, it's happening at the high frequencies. But then I said, okay, how about if I dig deeper to it? So if it is found that 60 hertz gravitational waves from rotating neutron star outside of our galaxy are focused onto the region having an approximate radius of 1.1 times 10 meters, assuming the concentrated mass that has a form of supermassive black hole. So although the phenomena exist, although the phenomena could be applied, although that it may affect the intergalaxy spaceship that we send into the space, it never applies to our communication or any communication of at any frequency in the Earth. Do you agree with that?
Yes, indeed. I never stated to my memory that it does. I just use that as an example that the path of electromagnetic waves can travel in a non-linear fashion. That's all I was using it for.
Thank you very much.
VDW?
Yes, VDW.
I was speaking with a gentleman from England today, and he was saying that the government isn't going to mix and match the vaccines, but instead of giving the booster at 3 weeks, they're now going to give the booster at 12 weeks. Because the numbers have jumped so high, they want everyone to get that first shot. What's your thoughts on that? Will that work?
Well, it's a slight move of quiet desperation, which I unfortunately can understand. It's untested. It may work. It probably, to a degree, will work. They will probably be able to get away with it. It makes a lot more sense than the mix-and-match nonsense. It's a way to stretch their supply. There have been studies that suggest that the first shot does offer a significant amount of immunity, not the 95 that the booster does, but any port in the storm. So it makes more sense to me than what I've read before, and it's a risk. I think it's not an unreasonable risk.
So I'm guessing we could see that move here or in other places. He was remarking how England was the first to approve it, and he was shocked that Israel was the one that had the most numbers of vaccine people, you know, done already. So, yeah, maybe that's the next move here to get it out to more people.
It certainly may come to that point, and especially judging from the short-term experiences of the UK and how it goes for them. But the problem is right now, our problem is not, our bottleneck is not our supply. We have, I think there's something like 10 million vials still in storage. So the problem is accelerating and making more efficient the rational distribution and inoculation of high-risk people, and then going down the line to the mildly risk, to the somewhat risk, to the not much risk. So at this point, it's not a matter of stretching the supply. It's figuring out how to actually send the supply to the right people as fast as we can.
Thank you, Roy. 73. Have a great year.
Thank you. You too. Well, it's 10:23. I want to remind people, as always, that if you have any questions or topics and or puzzles, or if you want me to poke Paul on the shoulder and ask him to look at a YouTube and such, if you need to contact me and you can't do it on the radio itself, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you forget that, you could always look me up in QRZ, and you can see how my shack is set up for doing these technical nets, if that interests you. I want to remind people that I put up some links. I have a nice little graphic of the ionosphere, the D, the E, the F1, the F2 layer, where it is in relationship to things. So take a look at that, and a nice link of YouTube of robots dancing. It'll give you a laugh. And remind you that I'm leaving TechNet stream on for the entire week at a time. So usually I shut it down in the middle of the night. If you go to technet.ac2gs.com, it'll be live and feeding you whatever Limark has going on W2VL. And always want to remind people, Mike, KC2NJI maintains an excellent archive of the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. So that's at amateurradio.tv. So thanks, everyone. I will be back to tie a bow on it at the end, but now it's time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet report.
Okay, this is WS2N with the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And I might recommend what is on Roy's website about the dancing robots. They were built by Boston Dynamics. The company's been around for a while. When you look at these dancing robots, if it wasn't Boston Dynamics, I would have said, well, maybe this is faked or something. But this is a regular company. In fact, they got involved for a few years building robots for the military, for the government. And now Hyundai Motor Company has bought up, I think, 80 or 90% of the company. So they have plenty of money to work with. But when you see this, you know, it's really incredible. You go to roy.ac2gs.com and click on that. You'll be shocked. I saw it about a week or so ago, and I sent it to my daughter, also a ham, N2WIN. She teaches, and now that the school's going to be starting up again, that is going to be all throughout the school, and I'm sure that's already spread like wildfire. Let me drop it there. Any comments, Roy, by the way?
No, I thought it was very entertaining, and yeah, you would think that someone had basically just CGI'd it, except that we've seen films, videos from this manufacturer, and like all things, I understand a part of Hyundai is now owned by a Chinese company, so the Chinese will be able to play with the robots as well. It's an incredible feat. Just the mechanics involved in keeping a biped up, and I'm sure they tried it a few times and failed. And you know, it's on a recorder or so. So you know, they get the moves right and then they film it. So it's still fascinating and very amusing. It brought a couple of laughs to me when I saw it on YouTube.
Yes, I agree. And you can tell the room that it's in, if you look up, it's glass walls all over. But if you look up at one point, you can see a couple of people walking around up there. They must have been involved, probably looking down at this. But it's pretty good. And I looked up the height. I think they're over 6 feet tall. There's four robots. Look the same, and then the other two are different looking. But it's pretty cool. Definitely worth it. As far as the SpaceNet report, I usually start off with important launches that will be coming up. Last week, I covered all the main launches that we pretty much covered on the net during the year. But as far as next year, for 2021. There's, of course, going to be a lot of launches worldwide. They'll probably be around 100 like they were this year. That would be worldwide. In the United States, we did about 40 of them. And that will hold true for next year, if not more. The one I'm looking forward for is the JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is this telescope that will be launched to the L2 position, the Lagrange 2 point, four times the distance of the moon, roughly around a million miles out into space. It kind of like won't be orbiting the Earth, it'll be following the Earth all the way around the sun. And they do that in that location to set up a sunshade and get away from the light, which is really the heat from the Earth, from the moon and the sun. They'll have this 50-foot sunshade about the size of a tennis court protecting this 21-foot diameter gold-plated mirror, which will do visual, but it's primarily set up for infrared. That's why they need to keep any heat away from it. So it picks up the slightest heat signature from the galaxies that it will be looking at. But space, it will take around a couple of months to get. I think around a month and a half to get to that location after being launched from French Guiana down in South America by the European Space Agency on an Ariane 5, and probably one of the last Ariane 5 rockets to go up. They're going to be switching over to Ariane 6 very soon. But that should be an exciting launch, and that will be in October, hopefully. Now, this thing should have been launched in 2017. That was the original date, and they spent about $10 billion on it. But due to complications with this origami setup that has to unfold during the trip all the way out, this 1 month or 6 week trip out to L2, as it's unfolding, 7 pyrotechnics that have to go off and see a certain sequence to unfurl this big sunshade that's 5 layers thick, separating one from the other. They're not even touching. It's as big as a tennis court, and having the telescope itself sit up on top. The telescope also is made up in, I think it's 18 different segments, all gold-plated, hexagonal-looking segments, roughly about a meter each, and collectively winds up a little over 21 feet in diameter. That will all open up. And of course, we'll cover that on the net if this thing ever gets off the ground. Being built by Northrop Grumman, and that's the one main launch. Of course, there's many launches before that. There's a lot of what I consider small as boring launches. There's plenty of spy satellites that'll be going up worldwide and things like that. But as far as the ones that we'll cover here will be the Progress cargo mission, and that'll be early February 15th. And then February 18th we'll be covering the landing of the Perseverance rover on Mars. It's going to land at Jezero Crater. We'll cover that one, of course, intently. That's the one. It's a little bigger, a little heavier than Curiosity. Roughly the same design. Hopefully that will successfully land on Mars. Other launches will be Antares, another cargo mission. The Antares launch launches the Cygnus cargo spacecraft to the International Space Station. And that will also be in February. Then in March, you'll have the orbital test flight for a Starliner. And that will eventually carry 4 people on. First mission will carry 3. This very first mission will be unmanned. They're going to try duplicating what they tried to do last December, 2019 December. When a spacecraft was supposed to go up unmanned all the way to the space station, dock with the space station, and eventually undock and return to Earth. It never made it that far. It had computer malfunction on the spacecraft itself. They had different settings for the clocks, and they realized there was 80 other different problems with the spacecraft that needed to be addressed. And they finally have everything done, and that will be launching at the very end of March, March 29th. And that should dock with the space station, stay there for about a couple of weeks, and eventually come back and land on land. Now, that will be the first time that the United States will take this type of a spacecraft and land it on land. We've, of course, done the space shuttles, but these are old-fashioned spacecraft like the Apollo days. You know, they always came down in the water. Well, this one's going to come down on land. I said these big airbags should be interesting. That will land in Utah. Then you have followed that by you're going to have another crew launch on a Falcon 9. You have four guys up there now, four astronauts that went a couple months ago, and they'll be returning about 3-4 months from now, and eventually they'll have another crew of four going up on another SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, and that will probably be in May. That will be followed by an actual crew going on that Starliner I was just talking about before, the Boeing build. That will, you know, if that Starliner makes it to the International Space Station and comes back safely in June, they'll actually send a crew up, and I believe it's crew of three that will be going up on another Starliner. These things are all reusable, but they have another one also being built for a crew, so we'll be looking forward to that. And that's pretty much it for now. It's hard to get a list past September, but this gives me up to July, and except for the October mission with the James Webb Space Telescope. Let me drop it, see if anybody has any questions, comments, before I continue. This is WS2N. Okay, we have talking about Cygnus. There is a Cygnus cargo vehicle presently attached to the International Space Station. It was the 14th mission that Cygnus embarked onto the space station over the few years, or I guess it's 2014 or so, since they've been going up to the space station. They've had 14 launches. One launch didn't make it early on. It blew up near the launch pad. The launch pad is located in Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. And they of course, corrected that problem. But it took a while. They decided to do away with the old engines that they had, these NK-1 engines that Aerojet was rebuilding. And now have gone with newer engines, RD-181s, built in the Ukraine. The whole first stage is built in the Ukraine and shipped over here. The second stage, and Cygnus is not built in the Ukraine. But Northrop Grumman launches these things now. This is the third one that they launched before they bought up Orbital ATK. Orbital ATK used to build these things in the Antares rocket with the Cygnus spacecraft. But naturally, one company is always gobbling up the other company. That's what happened here. So Orbital ATK got built, bought up by Northrop Grumman. But they'll be undocking from the space station on this Wednesday, which if I get a chance, I like to watch. I'll watch a replay on the NASA TV. They'll separate from the space station and then float away. And unlike all the other undocking vehicles, either the crew vehicles or the other cargo vehicles that go up to the space station, Japan has one, the HTV and the Dragon. When they return, right away. Cygnus doesn't do that. They become their own space ship and fly around for a couple of weeks. In one case, they stayed up there for a couple of months. And they do other science experiments that were put on board before they launched. And that's what Cygnus will be doing. They have their own little experiments that they do. And there's one that they always do is they set a fire off in a box inside the Cygnus. And they do experiments seeing how planes move in zero-G gravity and different kinds of materials and that type of thing, or what kind of fire retardants they do that work best. And they do a lot of fire experiments on that. But when they are done, it does re-enter the atmosphere and burn up over the South Pacific, like most of them do. Naturally, all the crew vehicles, the Dragon crew vehicle, of course, comes back with the crew. And then the Progress spacecraft also, of course, Soyuz spacecraft comes back to Kazakhstan. And the cargo vehicles, Progress, Cygnus, the HTV by Japan, and then the cargo Dragon vehicle, they all burn up over the South Pacific. They load them up with trash, things that they don't need on the space station. And with seven people now on board the space station, you do wind up with quite a bit of junk that has to be destroyed. Let me drop it. Anyway, this thing was named after Kapana Chawa. She was one of the astronauts on STS-107, which was the doomed Columbia flight that didn't make it back in 2003, February. And what this company does is when they launch a Cygnus spacecraft, they always take somebody that's passed away. Usually an astronaut, they do that all the time. Launch it. So that's what they did. And they honor somebody that... When it went up, it brought up a couple of thousand pounds of crew supplies, brought up almost 3,000 scientific experiments, walking equipment, parts of spacesuits, suits, or whatever they need, backpacks, and then hardware for different parts of the space station. They bring up stuff for the Russians. They needed more batteries, some battery replacements for the Zarya module. That's one of the big modules that the Russians had put up there years ago. The space station has 20 different rooms you could go into. 20 different doors you could kick it open and close. Many different modules. And the Russians have put quite a few up themselves, as well as the United States. Modules have been built by Japan. Modules like the Columbus module has been built by European Space Agency. A whole bunch of them. That's what the space station consists of. It's big as a football field, and that's why we can see it. Sometimes they give out the time that we can see it when it's going overhead. So that's the story on Cygnus, and hopefully that works out okay. Any questions or comments? This is WS2S. Okay, nothing heard. Another article I came across, as I keep looking up stories about the Arecibo antenna that has completely been demolished, and now they're paying to actually remove it piece by piece. Unfortunately, a big 3-inch diameter cable at one point broke, and then another one broke, and before you know it, this overhead piece of the antenna in Puerto Rico that came down and destroyed the whole 300 meter diameter telescope, a little over that, and completely destroyed everything. Now it turns out the government of Puerto Rico is looking to rebuild this. That's the first thing I said, when I heard that this thing was destroyed. Why not rebuild this whole thing? This thing was constructed in the 1960s. You could build it with more modern stuff, lighter materials, stronger materials. And they plan on doing exactly that. They think it might take them 10 years, but they plan on raising money or putting money toward rebuilding Arecibo. And why not, right now the biggest one is in China. And they call that, that's a 1,500-foot diameter antenna, but that one isn't as active. You can't transmit with that one. You know, that's just a big receiver. This one in Arecibo, they seem to be able to transmit, which means radar, you know, take pictures of different asteroids and see what they look like. They've sent signals to Venus, reflected signals from Jupiter. So, you know, they have the capability of doing transmissions with this one where China doesn't. To make this even bigger than the last one. So I hope they do that. Of course, it's going to take, like I said, 10 years. But all new electronics. And maybe it'll get involved with SETI. At one point, they made a transmission on in the 90s with this thing. They sent out a signal hoping that, you know, some alien group 25 light years from now would pick this signal up maybe and receive it and come back in there and maybe cure cancer for us or something. But that was one of the things they actually did. They sent some message out from Arecibo. Eventually, of course, Congress shut that down. They didn't want to pay any money for it. It's really not operated by NASA. NASA will pay to use it, but there's the National Science Foundation, the NSF. They're the ones that really construct and maintain Arecibo. So they're actually funded differently, you know, different money from the NASA budget. National Science Foundation has their own budget. So it's for that. Hope that all works out for them. Because, you know, our country, of course, needs to have something like that. We don't want China to catch up on something like the Arecibo. But right now, for now, they're I guess the only game in town. But hopefully not for long. We do have other antennas that, you know, do work. They connect to one another, interferometry, so, you know, you could have two or four or ten antennas that are linked together. And interferometry, and they act as one big antenna for radio astronomy. And for those that are interested, this club, Weimark, will have special guests talking on, I think it's February 13th. I'll have to check the log again. I'm pretty sure it's February 13th. Anyway, it's the next club meeting. It's a Wednesday. And I forgot the guy's name. But he's an expert in radio astronomy. And he'll be giving a talk. He'll be a presenter for that meeting, which I definitely intend on listening to. Any other questions or comments? Vehicles for future planned missions to the moon. Actually, one everybody in NASA talks about is the Artemis program. Artemis was eventually sent four people to the moon. They thought it was going to happen in 2024. Well, anyway, this administration thought it was going to happen in 2024. The previous administration set up Artemis. Well, they didn't have a name, Artemis, at the time, but they set up the potential landing of the Orion spacecraft using the Space Launch System in 2028. And I think we're coming back to that date again. NASA was not funded the extra money all these years to accomplish that. It would take roughly another $4 billion per year, and that was not allocated. They wound up with a little bit more money every year, and so they're able to keep going with existing programs such as Artemis. But they would need a lot more money to accomplish paying for a lander, to actually land on the moon, paying for an ascent module and also an orbiter, and it would eventually take every, you know, launch everybody together, put everybody back onto our Orion, and send them back to Earth. So there's not enough money for that. But one good thing is with this administration, they really believe in science. So I'm sure that will help different agencies like NOAA, NASA, National Science Foundation. Maybe it'll split the difference. 2024, 2028. Maybe we'll make it 2026. Anyway, they have 18 astronauts that have been picked out for that program. It's going to be naturally, eventually, many moonshots. Astronauts eventually going to the moon. The final goal is to establish a base, maybe a temporary base on the moon, most likely in the South Pole. Hopefully that will come about someday. They still plan on putting the Gateway space station around the moon. That's still a plan, but again, I don't see much money dedicated for that. That's a space station that will be flying roughly around 40,000 kilometers high and coming down, to maybe 1,000 kilometers off the surface, so a highly elliptical or a halo orbit. So this way, that could be manned, maybe a couple of months at a time. You might send a crew out there, dock with the Gateway station, get them ready for landing. They could get into a landing vehicle, which will consist of another transporter type of vehicle that will get them from this high 40,000 kilometer orbit down to around 60 miles above the surface. That's what the transfer vehicle would do. And then you would go from the transfer vehicle into the lander. The lander would separate from the transfer vehicle, and now you're orbiting at 100 miles above the surface. Now you're 60 miles, and then you drop down and land, spend some time on the surface, maybe weeks, or who knows, all four people, leave nobody in the transfer vehicle. When your time is up, everybody launches on an ascent vehicle, similar to what they did on with the LEM. You're leaving the descent stage as a launch pod platform. The ascent stage takes off, docks with the transfer vehicle, and then you go back to the upper orbit of the Gateway module, dock with that, and say hello to the people that are still flying around in that. That's their home for a while, and then you can leave them behind, and the crew that has to send out to land there will return, supposedly four people at a time. They'll return on the Orion spacecraft, come back and deorbit, parachutes, and land in the Pacific Ocean, and get picked up by a ship. So that's the crew version of what will be going on. Now, there's many unmanned vehicles that are planned going to the moon. One that's funded is the Viper mission by NASA. Viper's unmanned mission that will have a rover, dig up the surface, that type of thing. Investigate the wherever they might send it. But then there's another one called Peregrine mission. Peregrine is built by Astrobiotic Technology. And they plan on going up by the end of this year. Peregrine is a cargo vehicle, stands higher than a 6 foot man, say about 8 foot tall, and so it's like a mini LEM. So it's really set up for cargo, maybe bringing cargo to an outpost, or bringing science vehicles like rovers or other types of vehicles like that to the surface of the moon. And it will be launched on another new vehicle being built by Boeing and Lockheed. Boeing and Lockheed are working together on building the Vulcan rocket. Vulcan rocket is a rocket that will eventually replace the reliable Atlas V rocket and the Delta IV rocket. So it will be a heavy lift vehicle that will be able to not only launch satellites, but again, will be able to launch people like the Atlas will be doing when it launches the Starliner Boeing spacecraft to the space station. So Vulcan is being built, and they have brand new engines instead of using the Russian RD-180 engines that are presently used for the Atlas vehicle. They have the DE-4 engines that are being built by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is a space company owned and operated by Jeff Bezos, owner and operator of Amazon. So yeah, he's got this space company, but Blue Origin will be involved with putting their engines, the DE-4 engines, which are instead of being run on kerosene, like most rockets are nowadays, they're running it on liquid methane. Liquid methane and liquid oxygen. None of them have flown yet, but they've got plenty of time testing these DE-4 engines. So they're supposed to be pretty good, reliable, very powerful, 450,000 pounds of thrust, that type of thing. They're going to put two of them in there, so you're up to almost 1 million pounds of thrust on the new Vulcan rocket.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock.
Vulcan will be capable of running solid boosters attached to it as well, built by Northrop Grumman. They have a new 5-foot diameter. Pretty tall, I think around 10 or 12 feet tall, solid booster rockets that will add tremendous thrust to the new Vulcan rocket. Well, the Vulcan, which is new, the new engines, the DE-4 engines by Blue Origin, all new, will launch Peregrine. Again, Peregrine, all new. And they plan on doing this all before the end of the year, before 2021 is up. Peregrine, of course, is one I mentioned that will be able to bring cargoes and supplies to an outpost that was a manned outpost, maybe. But in the beginning, 2021, one of the first things that we'll be bringing will be the spider-looking thing. It's called Azagamal. I think it's pronounced. It's a strange-looking thing. It's got four legs, but it looks like a spider. It's not that big. Very small. It's like only about maybe a foot high or so. But instead of having wheels like a rover, Azagamal will have four legs. Off it's going to go. It'll leave the Peregrine lander, and they will wander through the surface of the moon and see how it does. It's being built by the UK. First vehicle or spacecraft that they've made that will actually go to the moon. But, it's getting a ride on the Peregrine little lander, and the Peregrine is being given a ride on the Vulcan, the new Vulcan rocket being built by the United Launch Alliance, which is a consortium of Boeing and Lockheed Launch. So, with that, let me close. I should wrap up around 11 o'clock, but we'll stand by if anybody has any questions, comments for the space portion of the TechNet. This is WS2N.
Paul, WB2BXO on Echo Link, I think, has a question for you.
Okay, let me stand by for WB2, CXL. Yeah, go ahead. All WS1.
Yes, Paul, and Roy, thanks for letting me in. I thought maybe somebody stepped on me and I just hadn't been heard. Anyways, everybody copy me okay before I just start talking here?
Yeah, you're doing great. I should definitely drop it once in a while and hang out for a while. Roy, you got to remind us of some stuff. I can't remember. We think I'm on HF. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Frank, WB2BX, so Paul. Couple of things. First of all, I recall years ago, back in the 80s, I used to do a field day with BARA, Bergen Amateur Radio Association in New Jersey. Yo, Jerry, N-O-2-T, told me that he had hand-built, designed and hand-built the parametric 432 megahertz amplifier that was used for Arecibo's Venus mapping project. And, of course, we know that K1JT from Princeton, who I don't think has ever been on the net, maybe he was once years ago, but I don't remember for sure, was also heavily involved in that. I think he said once he stood in the focus of the telescope with an HT and a kerchunk the moon. It's entirely plausible given the gain of that thing at the focus. Anyway, so, yeah, that telescope has some interesting amateur radio history. And I believe some ham contacts were actually made using the dish also, but I don't remember who was involved in that. You're interested in space communications, eclectic tech. Last Thursday talked about a Canadian ham who received signals from Mars MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, using amateur equipment. A very interesting story if you haven't heard that. And just briefly before I time out a bagel, a repeater, there was a story that a couple of YouTube generated a lot of excitement on YouTube about a 980-002 megahertz signal coming from the direction that was heard by Breakthrough Listen, coming from the direction of Proxima Centauri, which I think most astronomers think will ultimately turn out to be a reflection, either a satellite or a reflection from a terrestrial source. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I heard that. It was just less than a 1 gig, a little over 900 megahertz. Very good, yeah. But I think they're looking to find out if it's repeatable. When they were looking at it, they turned the radio antenna away from it. They noticed the signal dropped off. And then when they turned back to Proxima Centauri, it picked up again. So that, you know, they know it's coming from there. But since that time, you know, when they stopped listening to it, they weren't able to hear it anymore. Now they're trying to figure out what it is. It didn't have any modulation. Well, that would have been great, you know, to hear, you know, some alien called CQ or something. But there was no modulation on the carrier. I wonder if you heard that. And okay, on the hand receiving MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter signal, that's pretty good. I wonder if he has. You know, it's got to be ciphered. I don't know if they can pick up I think sending pictures and everything, telemetry for the weather or whatever. They're getting information either from pictures they're taking, the MRO is taking, or data, you know, that satellite has.